and welcome to the EDH Retcast. My name is Joey Schultz, and I'm joined, as always, by my fantastic co-hosts. First up, he's never really gotten over the fact that the Strixhaven spell Snow Day isn't a snow card. It's Matt Morgan.
You know, after today, I've just decided that the first 5 days after the weekend really are the hardest days.
I will absolutely sign off on that. You know, let's get all weekends all the time. How's that sound?
I'm fine with all weekends all the time.
That sounds good to me, too. Up next, he really wishes that Wizards of the Coast had used the KonMari method with the Planeswalkers from back in Dominaria because they just didn't spark Joyra. It's Dana Roach.
I either have a head cold right now or serious allergies, or I'm turning into an old-timey crooner. I'm not sure which, but it's definitely one of those three.
One of those three. Your voice is like a modal spell.
Right,
the decisions are chosen at random sometimes. I look forward to the crooning. I look forward to the song if it does come up in this episode. No,
bust out New York, New York here at some point.
I did think actually Casey Kasem was guesting on the podcast.
Maybe that could be.
For a second.
Anyway, this is the EDH Reccast. EDH Rec is the best deck building resource on the web for the Commander format, compiling data from deck lists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for new Commander decks. And here on the podcast, what we like to do is give all that data a little more context. Hey Matt, what is it that we're tackling in this week's episode?
Well, this week we're going to recover Modern Horizons. There was so much we couldn't do it in just a single episode. So this week's episode, just Modern Horizons 2, Cardboard Boogaloo.
Modern Horizons, Too Fast, Too Furious, the second part of our set review. But before we get to all of that cool Modern Horizons stuff, let's pause real quick and give a huge thank you to the folks at the Command Zone, since they handle the post-production work on our podcast, making it look as awesome as it does. And of course, we want to thank our sponsors for the show as well.
We are sponsored by Card Kingdom and TCG Player. If you want to support the show, just go to EDH Rec and click on whatever card you want to purchase, choose the vendor link down below, and go to the site. Doing so supports both EDH Rec and the podcast.
And if you would prefer to support the show directly, you can do so over at patreon.com/EDH Reccast. We have patron exclusive content coming out every single month and extra goodies over there, plus a patron exclusive altar sleeve that we're going to be sending out here very soon. We're very excited for that. So make sure you head over to patreon.com/EDH Reccast. And we cannot forget, obviously, Casey Simonetta as our very, very special patron of the week. So thank you so much, Casey. We definitely appreciate your support.
Thank you so much. Okay, fellas, let's get to our Modern Horizons 2 and the Chamber of Secrets. I'm running out of sequel names. But let's get to some of these other cards. We are discussing the red cards, the green cards, the artifacts, some lands, and also some remaining gold cards here as well. But real quick, listeners are probably familiar with the fact that in the last episode, when we talked about, like, you know, white cards and blue cards and black cards, there was a white card that we left off of the list, the card Resurgent Belief. And the reason we didn't address it is because it came out the day after we recorded that podcast. We were trying to get a jump on things, so we missed this one. It came out the day after we recorded. But y'all, let's start off with this one to cover our bases. Dana, what do you think of the card Resurgent Belief, a suspend replenish?
I'm torn. If you don't have a replenish, and it's a really, really pricey card, this is a pretty decent replacement for it. But telegraphing what you're going to do really robs a lot of the power from the effect. Now, it's only two turns, so that's a relatively short clock for people to respond to your graveyard. But it's also kind of a long clock for you to try to win the game if you're planning on throwing a bunch of auras on some creature and punching through for lethal damage. I have a deck where I could run it. I just haven't decided if I want to yet. So it's right on the edge of being strong enough for my deck as far as I'm concerned.
See, I'm a big fan of this Resurgent Belief. Like, you are right, Dana. Replenish is not played very much because it's a reserveless card. It's a very pricey card. So a lot of folks are not playing it specifically for that reason. Giving people a chance to play this on a budget. Yes, the suspend is kind of iffy. I'm also not a big fan of that, but I think the effect is going to be powerful enough. I know my Alila deck is definitely going to give this a glance. Yes, you can play around it. It gives people two turns to respond and, you know, possibly play some graveyard hate on you. I don't know why, because usually you save that for the graveyard player, like a one Joseph Schultz. But I really do like this card. I see the qualms about suspend. I like the suspend a little bit more than I do on the demonic tutor with suspend, where you're waiting two turns before you get a card that you like. So of the suspend cycle, I think this might be my favorite one.
I happen to agree with you there. This is a thing that, like, If you're playing Enchantress, you know where this effect could be good. And even if folks do respond with graveyard hate to it, like, I mean, it's still like a good thing to risk just in case. Like, this can be a very powerful effect. And even if you're getting just like three things back with it, that still sounds okay, actually.
I mean, and if you're playing sagas with this too, like, this is a great way to recur your sagas, stuff like that. There's a bunch of good stuff.
If you get one thing back, it's not bad. If you get like a Mystic Remora back, or you throw a Battle Mastery on, you know, something that you're swinging with for a lot of damage, like, you don't even have to get a ton of things back. It can still be very impactful.
Yeah, it is only two mana, yeah.
Yeah, so it does seem like it is going to be a little bit, you know, cornered into, you probably got to be pretty dedicated to the Enchantress strategy, but it is still definitely very interesting for that strategy. So absolutely, you know, really liking that of the suspense cycle in particular. Okay, now let's get on to the other cards, the other colors that we haven't addressed yet, starting with red. The first red card that we've got here is the card Harmonic Prodigy, a 2-mana human wizard 1/3 with prowess that also says if an ability of a shaman or another wizard you control triggers, that ability triggers an additional time. Not gonna lie, the first time I saw this card, I was kind of like, I don't know how much that will actually do anything to. I guess Enala, the wizard tribal commander, will probably enjoy that, and that might be it. And then I started looking and I saw that there are actually quite a lot of wizards and shamans in the command zone that this might be going pretty well with, like Niv-Mizzet Perun, for example, which is a wizard and will deal some damages, or Vayrin also is a new Izzet wizard. Like, this actually has a number of homes.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Vayrin, because that card definitely gets out of hand pretty quick. It's fine, like, it'll be a good tribal card, but I'm not sure where outside tribal decks you're going to want to play this.
Yeah, I think it's going to go in decks where your commander is a wizard or shaman that has a triggered ability, and I think if you're not playing one of those decks, it's probably too unreliable to devote a slot to.
My real question is, I don't know what the math looks like when you have Vayrin in play, which is doubling up your spellcast triggers, and you have a Guttersnipe in play, which is a shaman, and you have Harmonic Prodigy in play. When you cast a sorcery, how many triggers are you getting off of the Guttersnipe? Because there's amplifications on both ends, and I don't know what the math on that looks like.
I believe the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. Okay. So yeah, this does have homes, but it does require a pretty dedicated slot, but it's still pretty cool to see. The next card that we have here to discuss, though, Matt, does this one make you hungry at all?
It doesn't, because I'm not really sure what is being eaten in the art. A little unappetizing, you might say, but the card, at least, not the art, the card is Chef's Kiss, quite literally. So Chef's Kiss is one red for an instant that says gain control of target spell that targets only a single permanent or player. You copy it, then you reselect targets at random for the spell and the copy, and the new targets cannot be you or a permanent you control. It's a lot of words for kind of a weird fork variant. What do you guys think?
I think I'm a fan of Wild Ricochet, and I still usually wind up cutting it from my red decks when I get down to about 105 cards. And I think I like that more than this. So I just don't know where, at least I personally, would find a home for it.
The best use case that I can see for this one is that it doesn't just hit instants and sorceries. So you can, like, if someone tries to use Song of the Dryads on your stuff, then you can gain control of that spell and reselect its target elsewhere. And then you would copy that spell, which then you get another token version of the Song of the Dryads. Like, that is interesting as a different type of response. But the random quality on this really makes me not savor it. And frankly, I don't quite get the flavor connection on how this ability resonates with the idea of Chef's Kiss. Like, this card is a confusing mess to me. And Dana, I'm with you. Wild Ricochet just seems like I would prefer the control ability.
Yeah, I mean, that we're getting a healthy field of, like, these types of abilities where you can change the target. I'm not really sure if this... I mean, granted, you get an extra copy of this instead of just changing the target once. But also, it's incredibly random, and I'm not sure if that's the part that makes me want to play it.
Well, next we have Galvanic Relay, which is 2 and a red for a sorcery. You exile the top card of your library, and during your next turn, you may play that card. It has Storm, which is the important part here. The other important part is it's during your next turn, and it's a sorcery. So you have to wait a full turn to get a chance to play whatever cards you wind up exiling. Man, I'm torn about this, because the first thing I thought of was, well, it might be interesting in some kind of a red-green landfall deck where if you happen to hit 3 lands or 4 lands with this, you could still play them. But there's already a green card called Sprouting Vines that does something kind of similar. I guess that wouldn't get you spells, it would just get you the lands. But I think in that deck, you prefer to get the lands over spells. I just don't know where I would play this in Commander, even though I quite like the card.
Yeah, I also want to like it. And like in Storm decks, this seems really interesting. Like the new Vayrin, for example, is really popular and loves having Storm cards because those will trigger Vayrin multiple times. But this restriction is actually pretty sizable. So I'm not sure, like, if it, like, it's the kind of card that is only going to be good if you're already doing something pretty busted that turn anyway. So the conversation to me kind of becomes like, is this useful as a red value card if you do have, like, you've played a couple of little spells here and there and then you can play this to set up for your next turn? Or is red good enough already? It already has a card advantage that it doesn't need that type of effect.
Yeah, it is kind of weird that it sets you up for the next turn. I'm not a big fan of it. I think I'd rather just play Commune with Lava. That way, if this is a card that you're top decking, Galvanic Relay really is just another dead card because it doesn't even cantrip. It just sets you up for the next turn. Whereas Commune with Lava, you can play, you know, X for a certain amount and you can still play those cards this turn and on your next turn. So this is only a common. It's fine. Like if it's a budget kind of card advantage, and I'm sure I'm saying this and like it's going to show up in a lot of decks, but I think Commune with Lava is probably a card that I would just play over this every single time.
So moving on then, there is another red card that Matt, it's also 3 mana here. And I think that this is one that you are definitely a fan of.
I am a fan of this one, actually. Brea's Apprentice, 2 and a red for an artifact creature, human artificer. It's a 2/3. When Brea's Apprentice enters the battlefield, you create a 1/1 colorless Thopter artifact creature token with flying, and then you can tap it and sacrifice an artifact to choose one. Either exile the top card of your library, and until the end of your next turn, you may play that card, or target creature gets +2/+0 until end of turn. This is a good, just if you're playing that mid-level type of deck, kind of battle cruisery, this card is either going to get you a lot of card advantage, probably more so than Galvanic Relay will, or it's just going to ping through for a lot of extra damage. You don't have to target your own creatures with it, the old Dana Roach special of pumping your opponent's creatures to deal damage. I like this. This is a good, just very middle-of-the-road type of card, but I think a lot of people are going to play it.
It does seem pretty darn useful in a Duretti deck, for example, because he loves sacrificing artifacts to revive them. Felden might also really enjoy it. And Ozgear is probably really happy to make multiple copies of this thing, too, since it does come with its own token as well that you can manipulate and put more artifacts into the graveyard and then have Ozgear make more tokens. Like, this definitely has homes.
Yeah, the ironic part about Brea's Apprentice is you mentioned a few decks where it's good, but I looked at a few friends' Brea lists, and in part because they're 4-color and you have just so many more options, it's probably not good enough for most Brea decks just because the decks are so stacked with quality creatures. But yeah, absolutely, like those mono-red artifact commanders where there's a lot fewer options, it'll definitely see play for sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's ironic that Brea's Apprentice is...
She can't apprentice under Brea.
Exactly. Brea doesn't need him anymore. That's pretty funny. So that's kind of all that we've got about the most notable stuff in red. And one of the reasons that we're kind of, you know, moving on from red so early is because there's a lot to talk about in green. So let's move to green now. Boy howdy. I lose my words when I start looking at green cards. Let's start off with one. I hope everyone's sitting down for this. Have y'all heard about the card Tireless Provisioner? This is a 3-mana, 3/2 elf scout with landfall. Whenever a land enters the battlefield under your control, you create a food token or a treasure token. Food, of course, can be sacrificed for life. Treasure can be sacrificed for mana. So, real quick, they made a Lotus Cobra, which usually, you know, landfall gives you a temporary mana of any color. They made that. That Lotus Cobra used to be a mythic, and now that ability is an uncommon where you can put the mana on layaway, or you can use it to gain a bunch of life. What is this card? What is this card? This thing's insanity.
How do you really feel, Joey? Because as someone who's cast Tireless Tracker, which is kind of the inspiration for this card, I've cast many a Tireless Tracker, and I anticipate casting many a Tireless Provisioner. Like, this card's very, very good, folks.
Like, Lotus Cobra sees play in tens of thousands of decks, and this will go right next to them. I know that it is, like, landfall decks are packed to the gills with amazing cards, but this is one that you will make room for. It's also one that Guillaume will make room for food tokens. It's also something that Korvold will take advantage of because you can sacrifice the treasures to, you know, draw cards there as well. Like, this thing is insane. Landfall has its homes. I can't believe this is an uncommon.
So this is the first card we're talking about, and it's the first card in a long series that's going to occur over the course of the next few minutes where we go, why did they give green this thing?
tell you what, Dana, do you want to talk to us about Sanctum Weaver then?
So speaking of why did they give green this thing, Sanctum Weaver, one in a green for an enchantment creature dryad, 0/2. But you can tap Sanctum Weaver to add mana of any one color where X is the number of enchantments you control. So it's Sarah's Sanctum on a creature in green.
Only, yeah, only it's green, not one.
Only it's green.
A long-standing tradition, like this is very much a historical set with throwbacks to Magic's history, and this is a throwback to a historical thing where green does white stuff but better. So here, instead of adding white mana, it adds mana of any one color. Fantastic. Should be a white card, but that's neither here nor there. This will get just straight jammed into any Enchantress deck and probably others as well.
This is a premature challenge to stats, people. This won't show up in enough Enchantress decks because it will be difficult to acquire. This is a good card that Enchantress decks really, really want. And also, if you want to do some especially nasty stuff with it, some enchantments that you might already be playing in an Enchantress deck might be stuff like Pemmon's Aura, which you can use to protect your enchanted creature, or that you can use to untap your enchanted creature. So this also creates infinite mana by tapping for a bunch of mana, using the Pemmon's Aura to untap itself, and just keep going and going and going. So this is also an infinite mana creator if you want to go down that route as well. So, you know, there's that also to look forward to. Cool!
Well, and even... like Sarah's Sanctum occasionally would come down in games and the person would have no enchantments in play, so it wouldn't do anything.
Yes.
This is an enchantment, so this always is at the very least a Llanowar Elf. Like, it always taps for something.
Yeah, I'm just going to need Joey to stop hanging out with CAG member Charlotte Sable, giving all those Pemmon's Auras type of ideas, because flashbacks to twitch.tv/EHRetcast. That did a lot of work, so let's not give people that idea.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a break and talk about something that Green already has had access to, and now it gets another one. It's called Timeless Witness, which is a throwback to Eternal Witness, which shows up in over 82,000 decks, by the way. So Timeless Witness is another version for 4 mana. When it enters the battlefield, you return target card from your graveyard to your hand. This one's also a 2/1, but it also has Eternalize, so you can make a 4/4 token copy of it by exiling it from your graveyard, and the Eternalize cost is 7 mana. So this is another Eternal Witness. Like, it's not going to supplant Eternal Witness by any means, but like the 4 mana cost, that doesn't mean that it's worse than Eternal Witness. It means that you can birthing pod from one Eternal Witness into a Timeless Witness, and I'm losing my mind again.
Like, if this didn't have Eternalize, if it was just a strictly worse Eternal Witness, it would still show up in 20,000 decks.
Yes.
Just for the ability to blink it and recur it and all the reason Eternal Witness is great, this would just be a slightly worse version of Eternal Witness that costs one more mana, but it has Eternalize, so there's going to be situations where it's even better.
See, I actually... the Resident Green player was not terribly impressed with this, because at this point, too, green has a lot of regrowth type of effects. So paying 4 mana for a 2/1 version, like, yes, if you're going to abuse it, you're going to abuse it, and that's fine. But like, I am never going to cast the Eternalize cost ever. At seven mana is so much mana. It's fine, but like, I'm not super impressed. Like, I'm sure people will play it because it's going to be much cheaper than Eternal Witness, and that there's some merit to that. But I mean, there's a lot of different versions of these effects that, like I said, there's probably 10, 15 regrowth effects, and I'm not sure that this is one of the best 5.
The difference is this is on a body, whereas things like Marin and Karador and Maldrotha can abuse it. So it will see plenty of play, but you're right, there's a lot of competition in those slots for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if you're playing the decks that are going to abuse it, yeah, like that's always going to happen with every card, but like the generic green deck, like I'm not sure this makes the cut in any of my just green X decks.
Yeah, but like for my purposes, you know, most of the reanimation stuff I can do is strictly tied to creatures, so creatures that can get spells back for me are pretty impressive, and this will absolutely join alongside them because it's pretty insane. You are right, though, that I doubt I'll ever use the Eternalized cost, but you know what? It's nice to have the option, I guess, because green needs more options. Speaking of which, Dana, tell us about our next green card.
Up next, we have Foundation Breaker, 3 and a green for an elemental, 2/2. When Foundation Breaker enters the battlefield, you may destroy target artifact or enchantment. And it has Evoke for 1 and a green. So it's just a way to rec stage something for a little bit cheaper.
I would love to have a 2-mana Evoke the sacrifices so that I get an experience counter from my Marin. Yes, I would like to have that. Or I only need to pay 2 mana in a Muldrotha deck to get that effect. Yes, and it goes right back to the graveyard, so I can do it again next turn. That sounds great.
Or just automatically dome somebody on an Omnath Locus of Rage deck because it's an elemental.
That's exact. I didn't realize that was an elemental until we started looking at the show notes. And 100% is going into Omnath because I'm already playing, was it Seal of Primordium? And this is just a better version of that for that deck. Turns out putting a relevant creature type on a creature makes more decks want to play it.
This is usually where they like make it a goat or an ox or something so it like can't interact with something like that. But nope, they made it an elemental.
Okay, I need a moment. So Matt, tell us about our next green card.
So the next green card, Herd Baloth. It's going to be 3GG for a 4/4 beast. Whenever one or more +1/+1 counters are put on Herd Baloth, you may create a 4/4 green beast creature token. As soon as this card was previewed, everybody jumped about, Ivy Lane Denizen, where whenever creatures comes in the battlefield, you put a +1/+1 counter on a creature, which you would then put on Herd Baloth to start the process all over again. A lot of +1/+1 counter decks in general are just going to love this card.
Cathar's Crusade is another one. When a creature enters, you can put +1 counters on all your creatures. So Herd Baloth may make you a 4/4, so you can do it all over again. This is a combo thing. Once again, I'm trying to keep myself together, but this is pretty good.
And we're not even halfway through green, and Joey's already losing his mind. But there's also like a very obvious twist on kind of the most recent Iridescent Horn Beetle, which was a creature that at the end of your turn you created 1/1 tokens for every +1/+1 counter that was put onto creatures this turn, whereas this only cares specifically about +1/+1 counters that are put onto Herd Baloth itself. So it's a little bit of a twist. This is obviously the combo heavy version of that, but still a very, very powerful card, obviously.
Yeah, a good thing to shout there. Like, there might be a difference in like whether you're going to get multiple instances of putting counters on things, or if you just want to put a whole bunch of counters on things, in which case there are two different green options for you. So you've got plenty of options to choose from there. Matt, Sylvan Anthem has to be catching your eye, no?
In the words of Dana, it's green doing things that white normally does, only better. It's an anthem effect that has the tacked on ability to scry you one. So Sylvan Anthem, green for an enchantment, green creatures you get, or green creatures you control get +1/+1, and then whenever a green creature enters the battlefield under your control, you scry one. This kind of has some Path of Discovery vibes, excuse me. It's fine, like if you're playing a very go wide deck, this is going to do a lot of damage, and then just the scry one is just extra bonus. It's kind of cool effect, but I'm not really sure if I have any decks specifically that go wide enough to benefit from this.
That's fair. It's notable that it also includes your tokens, so like there is a way to get a lot of scry off of this.
Yeah,
and that's pretty significant. But it does also probably require a bit more dedication than the typical anthem, maybe.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, if you're just playing a green beater creature deck, this doesn't do you any good. But if you're playing some kind of an elf deck or a very dedicated token deck, in that deck, you are going to churn through your top cards of your library when you put in those, you know, 14 Avengers Endicard tokens or something. You're going to find the card you need very, very easily with this, in addition to it working as an anthem. So if anything, the scry portion of this is maybe the most valuable part.
What's amazing to me, you remember how Wizards of the Coast told us that Gaia's Anthem was a color shift away, that like, you know, that Gaia's Anthem is a green anthem, but like green's not usually supposed to do that. Its anthems are supposed to be tied to the fact of whether it has creatures. Its creatures is supposed to be like Beastmaster Ascension. You rely upon creatures to pump up your stuff. But apparently Gaia's Anthem is within green slice of the color pie after all, instead of being a plain shift color bend. So that's nice to see. But also Wizards told us that scry would be primary in white. And then stuff like Sylvan Anthem comes around and says, I'm a better version of white cards that also has scry tacked on, and I'm probably not even the best green anthem out there. This would be killer if it was white, but it's probably like green's 9th or 10th, 11th best anthem out there. And that's just a hurts in the feels.
Yeah, totally agree. Up next here, we have Blessed Respite. An instant speed for one and a green, and it says target player shuffles their graveyard into their library.
Rude.
And then prevent all combat damage that will be dealt this turn. So you have two independent clauses there. Neither are required to succeed for the other one to go off. So you can stop someone from doing graveyard stuff, which I know Joey hates.
Mm-hmm.
You can save your graveyard at least somewhat, say, by putting it into your library, and you can fog. That's pretty useful over the OG fog for just paying one more colorless mana.
This is one of the best cards I've ever seen for Dana to be able to simultaneously scupper my strategy and Matt's combat step in the same turn.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, very powerful effect. Like, regular fogs maybe aren't worth it, but we've talked about some fogs with upside on the show, whether it's Arachnogenesis, where you can create some tokens in fog, or you can be like Joey's favorite, Moment's Peace, where you have a repeatable fog. Whenever you put a fog plus onto a card, like, it's always worth a little bit of a consideration. This one, like, their graveyard decks are very, very popular in Commander. So throwing that effect onto a fog, yeah, sign me up.
Yeah, I mean, usually you'd have to take a dedicated card slot to something like a Relic of Progenitus to just have Grave Hate in there. This also is a useful effect, even if there isn't a graveyard player at the table. Like, this is two birds with one stone, and I am dreading seeing it show up in both of your guys' lists.
Because you are both birds both. With that one stone.
Oh, no, it's funny because it's true.
Next, we have Endurance for one green-green. It's an elemental incarnation, a 3-4 with Flash and Reach and Evoke. when Endurance ETBs, up to one target player puts all of the cards from their graveyard on the bottom of their library in a random order, and the evoke cost is you exile a green card from your hand, similar to all the mythic evokes in this set. Graveyard hate, Joey. Mm. This card is made to make you miserable.
Yep, I'm looking forward to seeing this in Matt's beatdown decks as well, because Matt is a lover of cards like Scavenging Ooze, and this seems like a pretty efficient coupling up with that.
This is a super efficient version of that. Like, the only reason this card isn't going to be in 20,000 decks is because it's probably going to be pretty pricey. Like, this is a super powerful card that I know modern players are extremely excited about. It is Modern Horizons, after all. But a lot of players are going to want to have a lot of copies of this, whether you're Commander players and you want to put this in a lot of green decks, or you're modern players that you want to have your play set plus. This card is just, it's wild. It's so good. I don't know why this has Flash. I circled around to this card probably four or five times, and it did something new every single time.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a 3-4 for three. Like, it's a very good body.
It's just a good body. Yeah.
Yeah.
And once again, it's an elemental. So, like, in the decks that care about that, that's a pretty relevant creature type. Omnath, again, is going to lightning bolt somebody when you evoke this.
Dana, why do you have to tell me all these creatures are elementals? I don't want to spend all this money.
I'm ruining your budget for the month of June.
You totally are.
Yeah, like, so, you know, a card like Loaming Shaman, which is a card that also shuffles graveyards, it has to die for the shuffle effect to work. It only shows up in like 2,200 decks. But then there's also stuff like Scavenging Ooze, which shows up in 17,000. So I feel like this is a pretty in-demand effect, not least because you can shuffle your own graveyard back to start Green Sun Zenithing out your creatures again if you need to. Like, there are very few fail states on this card. And once again, it's nice to not have to dedicate a slot to something like Relic of Progenitus when you can just play an efficient creature alongside it that you can also blink, that you can also recur. Like, this thing seems pretty darn annoying. And like Matt said, the reasons for its numbers not being super high will most likely be a result of price, but like, it's an admirable little beater, and I'm loving all of the green graveyard hate in this set.
It's so, like, if you had to ask me, like, what this price, like, what this card, like, would never go below, like, it's never going to be cheaper than $20. Like, just looking at it, like, I hope it does. I really, really, really do, because I really don't want to spend $20 a copy on this.
It seems pretty darn good, and I'm not happy about it. So I say you shouldn't play it. I don't think you need it. It's too expensive. Yeah. You don't need this card. It's fine. It's fine.
Well, if nobody in your pot has a Blessed Respite and nobody in your pot has an Endurance, then maybe you can successfully cast Gaia's Will.
Ah, our next one. Yes. Tell us all about it, Dana.
Gaia's Will is the suspend card from green. Suspend 4 for a single green mana, so then you have 4 turns before it fires off. And it's Yawgmoth's Will in green. So until the end of turn, you may play lands and cast spells from your graveyard. And if a card will be put into your graveyard from anywhere this turn, you exile that card instead. It's straight up a Yawgmoth's Will in green with suspend.
See, I waiting 4 turns for this, like, the time cost, like, we talked about this with all the other suspend cards, like, this is the largest number, and like, I have zero desire to play this card.
I think that's completely fair. This one strikes me especially as you probably need to be playing a Cascade deck,
yeah,
for this to be in any way reliable. And I think there's plenty that you can do with it in that shell, but like, it's probably not worth it outside of that. But it is kind of like, listen, I know that this ability probably should never have been in black in the first place, but on top of everything else that green got this set, did it need this too?
Yeah, no, it didn't. no, that's your answer, Joey. It did not. Again, because like, if this is in white, where it probably, you could make the argument it could be a white effect, then it's much more interesting because there's a lot less, you know, powerful cards in white, and their graveyard recursion stuff tends to be a little bit weaker than what we've gotten in green. There's no Eternal Witness or 4 mana Eternal Witness in white. I think it's much more interesting there. And I think, unfortunately, in green, because there's so many other options, waiting four turns is a pretty huge ask.
I mean, Joey brought up a really good point. Like, if you're doing cascade type things or you're cheating, you know, playing this, like, that's fine. But, like, also, there's a whole format full of just unfair cheating things that you can be doing too. So, like, does this compete with those? Like, is the payoff worth the effort? So I'm not really sure, but I don't see it being that.
Yeah, but still notable to see what green is expanding itself into in terms of the color pie. That is one of the biggest stories overall from this set. So that's what we've got from the green cards. A whole lot of green cards that could be very, very relevant, and way too many graveyard exiling effects for my liking. So how about we move on and talk about some artifacts instead? Dana, you've got an artifact deck. Tell us about some of the artifacts that stand out to you from this set.
There's one that I haven't seen much conversation about, which is Nettle Cyst for 3 mana. It's an equipment, but it's a living weapon equipment. So when you cast it, when it ETBs, you create a 0/0 black Phyrexian Germ. But the important thing here is equipped creature gets +1/+1 for each artifact and or enchantment you control. So immediately this is a 3/3 that comes into play, and in the decks that are built around doing artifact and or enchantment things, this is going to be really big really, really often. And you also have the option to equip it for a relatively cheap price onto something that maybe has evasion or double strike or something. There's a lot of decks where this is just going to be a absolute bomb.
Doesn't it come down immediately as a 1/1 naturally? Or are you just sort of assuming like a lot of mana rocks pretty generally?
I'm assuming you're not going to be running it in a deck that doesn't have a bunch of things that are feeding it. Like, you're not going to put this in just a normal deck. It's going to be like in my Vela deck where I have, 49 different artifacts in there.
Yeah. This seems especially nice for any version of Akiri. Equipment decks are probably interested. If you're making a lot of food, here's a way to weaponize them. If you're making a lot of treasure tokens, here's another way to make it interesting and weaponize them. I would personally resist it in an Enchantress deck. It does count Enchantresses, but it's not an enchantment itself. So that does feel like a little bit of a non-bow there. Or Matt, maybe this is something you'd actually really like to play in your Alila deck.
It would be something I would play in my Alila deck. But I mean, Enchantress decks and enchantment themed decks, if you go to edhrec.com, check out the themes page. Helm of the Gods is getting played in a lot of enchantment decks. We've challenged that before, but I like this a little bit more because it at least counts itself. That was one of our biggest flaws. Like, why would you play this if it's not even going to feed itself? That said, like, I think all three of us are still a little hesitant to put this in those decks. But if you're playing both, like my Alila deck, this is going to be a pretty heavy hitter. It's pretty sweet. I like it. I think we all do. Yeah.
Yeah. Get you a Nettle Cyst that can do both. So we're not quite done with equipment. There are still plenty of other equipment to get onto. So here's a card that has gotten plenty of hype. Sword of Hearth and Home, one of the new Sword of Cycles. So a 3-mana sword that equips her 2, gives +2/+2 and protection from 2 different colors, in this case from green and from white. And whenever the equipped creature deals combat damage to a player, you exile up to 1 target creature you own, search your library for a basic land card, and put both onto the battlefield under your control and then shuffle. So it's a callback a bit to Sword of the Animist, which also fetches you a land when you attack, and it can blink one of your creatures. A lot of buzz about this one. Matt, it's protection from your color, so I imagine that this is one that maybe you're a little bit salty about first.
No, because I'm going to put it in those decks.
Yes, I see. That makes a lot of sense.
this card is, it's nutty. Like, we talked about those decks that like to spam and abuse the enter the battlefield abilities. This is that combined with, like you said, Joey, a Sword of the Animist type of ability. This is very, very... how many varies do I have time for? Because that's how good this card is.
Here, tell you what, Sword of the Animist appears in 33,000 decks. So this is pretty clearly an in-demand effect for an equipment that finds you lands. So that many varies, 33,000.
And I know this won't be in that many decks because this is going to be a pricey card.
Yes, there is.
People are going to want so many of these.
It's also much more universally useful than the 2 swords we got in Modern Horizons 1. Both of which were fine, but they tended to be targeted towards relatively specific commander decks that wanted, say, the proliferate effect or something. In this case, this is just good in a ton of decks. Like, there's just so many good ETB creatures in Commander. There's so many decks that want a ramp that don't have access to green. It's just a useful piece of equipment that protects you from the best targeted removal spells that target creatures and Swords to Plowshares and Path to Exile.
Yeah.
Just does a lot of great things that are accidentally going to be applicable to your deck.
And like you say, it protects from the best single target creature removal. It protects from the best creatures, like protection from green. And that's, if you're playing creatures, you're probably playing green. Like, that's just how this format is at this point. The protection is super, super relevant.
Yeah.
Especially if you're trying to get, like, deal combat damage to players. Being able to evade a lot of blockers is very powerful.
Yeah. This, I think, might be the second best sword still behind Feast and Famine, because those payoffs are especially powerful. And I think that this sword will run into occasions where there isn't necessarily always a creature for you to blink, especially if you're playing like an equipment deck where you might just have one creature that is equipped with a bunch of stuff that you don't want to leave the battlefield. But like, this is an in-demand effect with protection from two insanely useful colors to have protection from. Like, I'm scared of this, Matt's scared of this, and we both want to play it in decks that we've got.
See, I would put this at 1B to Feast and Famine's 1A. That's how keen I am on this card.
That's good. I like that. That's very fair. Absolutely. We're not done with equipment, though. So since I think I can hear Tomer from MTG Goldfish screaming in delight at this current moment, Dana, can you tell us all about why he might be so excited for this whole Cauldra thing?
So way back in the first Mirrodin block, there were three pieces of equipment that if you got them assembled on the same creature, you made a token, and it was a 5/5 that had indestructible in a bunch of things. And this is kind of one of those achievement unlocked things that Tomer in particular has been trying to do for a long time, is get the three Cauldra pieces out and get them assembled. And they're right here assembled for you on a creature that's, okay, it's a little bit evil, but, you know, some of the work's been done for you, so that's pretty cool.
So what else does this thing do? This is a lot of words for one mythic equipment.
It's 7 mana for a legendary artifact equipment. It's a living weapon, so it comes into play attached to a Phyrexian Germ, a 0/0, but it has indestructible itself, the equipment does, and the equipped creature gets +5/+5. It has first strike, it has trample, it has indestructible, it has haste, and whenever this creature deals combat damage to a creature, exile that creature. So immediately this thing is a 5/5 with every keyword that matters. And yes, you have to spend 7 to equip it elsewhere, but if you're playing an equipment deck, you probably have ways to cheat that cost as well.
Yeah, this thing is a beater. Like, I want to do a Modern Horizons 2 draft just to maybe open this and just crush. Like, I don't see how you lose playing this card.
You know, importantly, it doesn't give vigilance and lifelink. So if you are playing Tesa Karlov, you can supply it with 2 other keywords if you would like to do that for your tokens. Speaking of which, this is attached to a token right from the off. So Temet, the Vizier of Noctemoon, is probably really excited to have another token that he can make unblockable. It's occurring to me that maybe Tomer isn't happy about this card because he'll probably want to attach all of the Cauldra pieces to this Germ, which might be pushing the goalpost even farther for him. But yeah, if you're playing equipment, like, that's a tough equip cost that you can circumvent with creatures like Arden, for example, the partner that can auto-attach things for you. Or Nazan is another equipment deck whose hammer allows you to auto-attach stuff. You've got stuff like Pure Steel Paladin as well that can make your equip cost 0. Speaking of which, Sir Gwyn is a knight that lets your equipment attach to knights for 0. Like, this thing's got homes. This thing gone crush.
Yeah, it's really, well, and in addition to being good, it's, as I've said, it's just a super fun callback that a lot of people have been waiting to see kind of on a card. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the beauties of this set, is just seeing all the kind of tendrils back into Magic's history.
Yeah, this set manages to feel simultaneously like a silver-bordered set that is mm-hmm. also Time Spiral.
Right.
Like, making all of those throwbacks. Like, there's a lot of love going in here. And you know what? Speaking of Time Spiral, how about a new Suspend card, Soul Talisman? A costless artifact that you have to suspend for 3 to play, which only costs 1 mana, and it taps for 2 colorless. So it's a soul ring that you have to lay away in order to play. I'm a little bit softer on this one compared to some of the other artifacts that we've discussed so far.
It's better than Mox Tantalite, probably, which isn't that good of a card, I guess. If you see it in your hand in the first couple turns, it's pretty great. After that, I don't know if you want to have to wait 3 turns for a Soul Ring, but there are decks like we mentioned Doretti previously in the Brea's Apprentice segment. Even if you draw this on turn 7 or 8 or something, there are situations where, like, pitching it And then bringing it back into play with your commander is pretty useful. So there are corner cases, I think, where decks want this, but it's a far cry away from being Sol Ring.
The people that wanted this card banned, there was some Twitter discourse that this card was going to be outrageous, and I don't see it. Like you said, Dana, Mox Tantalite, not a terribly frightful card. Waiting three turns for a Sol Ring isn't what I want to be doing on turn 10.
Yeah. I think that another commander like Ozgear might also enjoy it, like finding ways to discard this, and then he can just zero get another free double Sol Ring-ish sort of thing going to play from the graveyard. Like, that's probably another great home for it, but it does seem a lot more niche compared. And like, this is a fair version of Sol Ring, and I'm perfectly happy with it. Glad that it exists.
Yeah, it's a fine card.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's a weird card. Academy Manufacturer. This is a 3-mana artifact creature assembly worker, a 1/3 that says if you would create a clue, or a food or a treasure token, instead you create one of each. This initially passed me by, but the more I look at it, the more I'm like, whoa, that seems really excellent. Like, Guillaume makes food, but now he'll also make other stuff alongside it. Or the new Lonus card as well, creates clue tokens, so now you get one of each every time that you're doing that. Like, this is also a card that maybe has niche homes, but it will be very impressive in those places.
Yeah, like you said, this is going to be impressive in a lot of different decks, because if you're making clue tokens consistently, this is going to be very good. If you're making food tokens consistently, it's going to be very good. Like, this just does so many good things. So, like, yeah, being able to create a bunch of food or treasure tokens, like, put this next to Smothering Tithe, you're never going to run out of cards. No, you're going to have so many clue tokens.
That's insane. Magna Brazen Outlaw also creates treasure tokens for you. So this is another amplification to that. Malcolm, the pirate partner, that also creates stuff. The new Galazeth Prismari also creates... there's a lot of... Yep. I like it. I like it in those decks. That is cool. This is a cool card.
Silly cards are silly, man.
Especially because it's treasure tokens on here. You know, we might go a long time before we see clues and food again, but they seem to be willing to put treasures in all kinds of different sets. And this is the kind of card that not only is very relevant in a bunch of decks right now, but is going to continue to become relevant as new commanders come out, like the ones you mentioned, that do interact with treasures, or as new cards come out that you put in your deck that make treasures. So this is a very good card in a bunch of places now, and it's going to be a very good card in new decks as new things get released.
Yeah, like, if you are a Boros deck that has a consistent way to create treasure tokens, this is a version of finding card advantage, and that's useful. Like, there's a lot of extra tricks that you can do with this, and I'm excited and scared.
Yeah, for sure. Up next, we have Dermotaxi, the best named card in the set. It's 2-mana 0/0 artifact vehicle. It has imprint, so as Dermotaxi enters the battlefield, you exile a creature card from a graveyard. Any graveyard, not just yours, from a graveyard. And you may tap two untapped creatures you control until end of turn. Dermotaxi becomes a copy of the exiled card, except it's a vehicle artifact in addition to its other types. So you just exile a thing, and your Dermotaxi becomes a copy of that thing, which is pretty gross, but a pretty fantastic card effect for sure.
You can't tell me this card, like, the art for it, was not inspired by the car from Dumb and Dumber. Like, the giant dog rolling down the street. Like, it looks exactly like this.
This strikes me as, like, weird, but it will be more powerful than I think it's going to be. Like, it sounds a little bit like, is that really going to happen if there's, like, you know, two squirrels crewing the body of an Emrakul the Promised End or something like that? Like, I don't know if that's necessarily the cards, but the fact is that it could be. And when it could be, it'll be very, very difficult to actually deal with, because that is one of the beautiful things about vehicles, is that if you've only got sorcery speed types of removal, they resist things like board wipes really consistently. So if you've got good creatures to get rid of, especially if I'm playing a graveyard deck, like, yeah, you won't get the ETB abilities of any of the creatures that you exile, but if you make a version of, like, a Grave Titan off of this, you're probably doing okay.
Yeah, I would feel perfectly okay with a couple of squirrels crewing my Sun Titan Dermotaxi. That'd be a perfectly fine thing to do.
Well, and guys, believe it or not, like, we're still not done with artifacts either. I know we spent a lot of time on green. Artifacts equally getting a lot of gems here. So next up, we have Void Mirror, which is 2-mana for an artifact that says whenever a player casts a spell, if no colored mana was spent to cast it, you counter that spell. And I know quite a few people seem to be up in arms about this card, but what do you guys think about it?
I'm sad for Ashlyn Rose because of her fantastic colorless Kozilek deck, and I'm also never going to play it against Ashlyn Rose because that just seems mean.
Yeah, and you know, It is a Kozilek deck, though. So, like, Ashwin's a wonderful person, and she plays a relatively fair Kozilek deck. There's a lot of Kozilek decks out there running, like, 40 mana rocks where Kozilek is coming down on turn four or something, where I feel way less sympathetic when this Void Mirror comes out. I do feel bad for the people playing Traxos or Hope of Kirapur, where it just, like, those decks are pretty tough to make a super crazy powerful version, and you are just going to get beaten when this comes down. But outside of that, this kind of feels like a card that, for the most part, hoses decks and strategies that kind of deserve to get hosed and probably are playing at a power level where they should be able to deal with it, or there's a bigger issue at play.
Wait, so you're saying that it's fair to counter my Fierce Guardianship that I cast for free, Dana?
I think the fact that you get to cast a counterspell for free, and this is occasionally, not all the time, occasionally going to be in play and prevent that, is perfectly reasonable. I think occasionally someone turning off your Mox Opal for free is probably a reasonable thing to have happen on occasion.
Yeah, I agree with all of this. Like, it's a fine card. Like, it's going to be more powerful in higher power level settings. Like, the more powerful decks that people are playing, the more this is going to do. Like, if you're playing a Battle Cruiser, everybody's just having fun doing whatever. Like, this card is going to do literally zero. Like, the more unfair things you do, the more this does. And like, Sheldon Mennery had a really good comment on it in his set review. Said, you know, it's getting easier and easier with power creep all over the place to do unfair things. And like, this just makes those unfair things a little harder to do, and that the format needs cards like this. And like, I tend to agree, like, if you're playing any deck that has any colors in it, tap a basic planes and you get around this card.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that hard, people. Just tap, play more basics, and you are totally fine.
Yeah, but pay lands to play spells. And that's also just the thing. Like, this is ultimately, aside from like a place where it is a higher power meta, like, this is a thing that is not going to show up. It is so, so niche that it almost, like, this is not a card that I expect to see, but it is certainly relevant for purposes of discussion.
Like, and the decks that get hosed by this, like, yes, there are decks out there that like struggle to do anything with this, but like, less than 1% of decks out there in the wild are those true colorless decks. And I really struggle to see the rules committee banning a card over less than 1% of decks not being able to play. Like, this Iona stopped more people from playing than this.
Right. One of my favorite takes on this, because there was plenty of dialogue about this card when it was coming out,
and plenty.
Folks were really up in arms about it. And I saw a lot of, what was it that Angelo at the Jeskai on Twitter, a fantastic follow, I think he put it best, where he said something to the effect of, a lot of my deck is only a 7, people seem really frustrated about this card.
Right. Yes.
Sort of seems kind of the tempo of that, I think. Yeah, Void Mirror, it's fine. You're probably not going to see it. It's very, very niche, but it's certainly interesting. Are we done with the artifacts? Like, there's some other stuff here, but I think we might need to move on because there's still plenty of other...
Kind of? We are kind of done with the artifacts, because we got a cycle of 10 different artifact lands.
Ah.
Because what could go wrong with artifact lands?
So yeah, they all enter the battlefield tapped. They're all indestructible, and there's one for each color pair. Dana, are you singing these praises? Like, you got to be happy about artifact lands, yeah?
I mean, I have two decks that care about the amount of artifacts in play, and I will be jamming both of these into those decks. My Vela deck in particular cares about artifacts in play, so I'll be putting the artifact land in there, as well as Energy Deposit, which was the 11th artifact land we got in this set, will be in there as well. They're in Commander, they're way less broken than they have been in other formats, and they will continue to be perfectly fine in Commander. They're also relatively niche. I don't think anyone's going to be running these unless you're on a super budget, just to have them as a dual land. They're pretty safe there, and I'm glad to see them added to the format.
Yeah, they're a fine cycle. It's good mana fixing. It's interesting space. The fact they come in to play tapped, I think they won't get near as out of hand as they did in Modern.
Yeah.
Or the single color ones, I should say.
Indeed. So moving on now. I thought that we were done with green doing stuff and other slices of the color pie. And it turns out, nope. Turns out we're not done with that. It turns out that they also made a card called Yavimaya Cradle of Growth, which is the green version of Urborg Tomb of Yawgmoth, a legendary land where each land is a forest in addition to its other land types. I'm not upset about this at all. I'm not upset about it. I'm not upset about this at all.
Now every land can be a bayou.
Like, this is good. Like, people use Urborg just to, you know, get a bit more security with color fixing. Urborg also obviously has synergies with stuff like Cabal Coffers. Green doesn't have its own Cabal Coffers equivalent. It does have creatures that get bigger based on the number of forests that you control. So stuff like Multani or Ashaya can certainly try and take advantage of situations like this. So that is certainly noteworthy. But I'm also just like, what, Watsy, did Green need this too?
White did. White could have used this, I think. That would have been pretty useful there. I don't know if green did. It's better in green than it is in white, but I would have rather have seen this on a white land for sure.
I don't know. Red would then just go like flash fires crazy with it.
So I guess, yeah. Better.
Yeah, I don't like this design space, honestly. Like, just because it was done in the past, I don't think it should not be a green light to keep playing in that space.
Well, yes. The point about the design space, Matt, is before we even get into all the things this interacts with nicely, I will mention, like, I drafted a ton of M15 back in the day. So I walked away from those drafts with half a dozen copies of Urborg when it was a $4-ish card that I have just kept over the years. And every black deck I've built, literally every one in the time since, I've put Urborg in because why not turn my strip mine into a swamp? Or if it's a 2 or 3 color deck, why not color fix perfectly with that Urborg in play? If you do nothing else but color fixing, it's worth running probably in the decks that can run it. And that's before we even get into the combo. So, like, it becomes kind of staple-ish in a way, and I don't necessarily love those cards.
I really don't want them to keep doing this. I like if they do this with mountains, there's going to be some problems because Valakut already exists. If they do that with plains, like you said, Joey, flash fires exist. Like, I think this is kind of dangerous. Like, I try not to be too hard on R&D, but like this one, I'm really struggling with.
Yeah. So speaking of like stuff that you can do with it, you know, Multani, I mentioned earlier, is probably really happy. Ashaya as well. But then there's also a handful of cards like Ambush Commander or Life and Limb that will have additional synergies with the fact that this is turning everything into forests. And Patron of the Orochi is another card that can untap all of your forests for you as well. So, like, there are some unique ways to take advantage of this effect. Personally, though, I anticipate that the commander that likes this the most is Kethys of the Hidden Hand, because it's another mana-producing legendary land that Kethys' ability can allow you to take advantage of, too.
Well, up last among the lands here, we have our first enchantment land. That's Urza's Saga, which is a saga that's not from Urza's Saga. Got all of that. You're one ahead of me. Urza's Saga, the first chapter, it gains tap and add a colorless mana to your mana pool. The second chapter spends 2 and tap to create a 0/0 colorless construct artifact creature with this creature gets +1/+1 for each artifact you control, so a construct, as they're called. And the third chapter, you search your library for an artifact card with mana cost 0 or 1 and put it onto the battlefield and then shuffle. So you can go get your Soul Ring or one of your artifact lands, for example.
Oh, it cannot get artifact lands, actually. The card does.
Okay.
Yeah, it needs to have a cost of 0 or 1. So a 0 mana rock is fine if you have like a mana crypt on hand, or a skull clamp is good, but artifact lands don't have a cost, so it cannot get those, which is the only bad thing I have to say about this card.
So you couldn't get a suspend thing as well if there was an artifact suspend card then for that, for example.
This is a very fascinating thing to see, and I'm going to level with you. I forgot that it was an enchantment, so I suspect that there might be a handful of constellation decks out there that are interested in a land that they can use for constellation triggers. Like, that seems pretty interesting for sure, but honestly, that token is no joke. Like, if you've ever seen folks make copies of those tokens that buff themselves up for each artifact, if you get multiples of them, they get out of hand really quickly. So having a land that can produce those and that will then just finish off by probably going and finding your Soul Ring once it's dead after the third chapter, I like this thing. This thing seems real cool. Not a staple everywhere, obviously, but like, if I'm playing an artifact deck, I'm interested.
Well, that second mode doesn't go away either. So when you come to the third chapter, you can still, on the third turn, you use it to make a second construct token.
And I really like that third chapter. There's some really juicy targets. Yes, it can get your Soul Ring, but there's some other really good targets out there. The Ozolith only costs 1 mana, and you can get the Ozolith with this animation module that goes a little silly with all sorts of different things. And if you really want to, like, just poo-poo on Joey, rain on his parade, you can get Grafdigger's Cage, really, too. That is an option.
Or Tormod's Crypt, or Relic of Preventatus, or Soul Guide Lantern, or Nihil Spellbound. bomb, so many options.
Pithing needle, like just shut down anything and everything.
Stop. No, we're done. So places that this card might also show up. Like artifact decks, I think, are interested in this. If you're playing an Urza deck, like this seems like it's probably going to be nice to go find something. I think potentially Emry or Joyra might also really like this because you can go and find more artifacts and you'll have plenty in play that that token will make. A colorless deck generally is probably a great home for this. But honestly, the one I'm most excited to see this is for a Bruticlad deck. Make a copy of that token and then turn all of your tokens into Karnstructs and they all count each other as they're buffing up. That seems especially spicy.
And, what, and the absolute best part about this is I can just pull a basic land to make room for it.
Yeah.
So it's an easy way to, it's easy to slot into my decks. Just, I'll just go down to six basics, I guess.
That's pretty messed up. But there's also, you can use some untappy shenanigans with this. So like if you've got Seedborn Muse, once it hits chapter two, you can use that ability every turn or like a Derevi deck maybe might untap this thing multiple times and then use it a whole bunch. It is an enchantment. So I think Estrid the Masked would also work for that. Like, there's some untappy stuff that you can do with this too. Like, this is a cool card. I'm a little bit scared about it.
Yeah, it's good. It also seems like so long ago that we first saw this card too. Like, it seems like it may as well have been in Kaldheim.
Oh, man. Okay, so now I think we're done with the lands. Let's move. There's a small number of multicolored cards that we should probably address. Matt, is there one that jumps out to you?
One that seems intriguing, that's kind of like probably one of the better mana dorks in Gruul colors, is Goblin and Narcomancer. Anarchomancer, it probably
Asmerana,
loves
Havoc. Asmerana, Camardica, Dyson, Occulticar. No, wait, that's different.
Yes, the Mary Poppins song on a goblin. So it's green and a red for a 2/2 goblin shaman, and each spell that you cast that's red or green costs one less to cast. So we talk about how like the medallion cycle makes all your spells of a certain color one less to cast. Those add up. It like you get a lot of discounts over the course of a couple turns. I like this. This is a pretty potent spell, and I'm curious to see how many decks this shows up in, especially since it's just a common.
Yeah, like the fact that this hits all of your red or green spells, like that is pretty big. That will hit the majority of your deck because these are the two colors that probably won't have a ton of artifacts in the deck that would take up, you know, slots where that doesn't do anything to these spells. Like, to my mind, in the decks where this will be useful, I feel like it's a little bit better than the typical Goblin Electromancer that it's throwing back to, because that only affects your instants and sorceries. And even in Spellslinger decks, sometimes the instants and sorceries that you're playing are just one mana cantrips that the Electromancer doesn't help with. And those are only like comprising like usually about a third of your deck. So it doesn't help you with the mana on all of your spells, like some of the cool enchantments or creatures that you might be playing. And an Archomancer doesn't have that problem. Like, this seems really great for Gruul.
Well, speaking of cards like are really great in specific decks, there's one more gold card I want to mention here. It's an artifact creature, Aethersworn Sphinx. 7 white and blue, so it's 9 mana. However, it has affinity for artifacts and flying and cascade for a 4/4. In the decks that want to run this, So we talked about Brea before. My Sphinx deck happens to have about 15 artifacts in it. So very frequently, it's going to be quite cheap to cast there. But like in that Brea deck, this is oftentimes going to come down pretty early in the game for 2 mana as a 4/4 with flying. That's going to then get you something probably possibly quite giant for free from your library. There's a lot of value to be had in decks that are going to consistently be able to cast this really, really cheaply.
Yeah, you've got a lot of really great value commons and uncommons happening here. And I do think that after this point, they do start drifting a little bit more, you know, niche places for them. But like, there's still going to be some gems from the set that, like, I find myself looking over the spoiler and being like, wait, that was from this,
right.
This set has that card too? Like, it definitely feels like one of those, I keep on finding new cards from the set every time that I look at it. So you'll find more gems from there for sure. Let's, real quick, since we have gone a little bit long, let's wrap up now with a handful of notes on the Planeswalkers. There are 3 different Planeswalkers from the set, and we've kind of agreed that before the show we were talking like, yeah, you know, I think these are also kind of niche. Dakon, the Shadow Slayer, is really cool, but it's an Esper card. Most likely Amanatu might end up being one of its best homes because it can, you know, get a bit more controlling as the game goes on, but there aren't a ton of homes for this deck. Another one is Geodrone Dihata, which is a Grixis sort of a villain thing that most likely we're probably going to end up seeing it in like a Nicol Bolas villain themed deck, but its abilities are a bit more circumscribed that Commander isn't going to be hugely for. But there is an interesting Planeswalker here called Grist the Hungertide, and it is a Golgari card, which means that Joey usually really likes it, and it's a Planeswalker that is somehow also a creature with some weird applications. So let's talk about those. Grist of the Hungertide is a 3-mana Golgari Planeswalker with 3 starting loyalty, but as long as it's not on the battlefield, it counts as a 1/1 insect creature in addition to its other types. It's got a +1 to create a black and green insect creature token, and you mill a card, and if you mill an insect, you repeat this process, and you get another loyalty counter on Grist. It also has a -2 where you can sacrifice a creature and then destroy a creature or planeswalker, and a -5 where each opponent loses life equal to the number of creature cards in your graveyard. But the most notable thing about this card is probably that it can be your commander.
Yeah, the rules committee did promise to have a full explanation once the set comes out on the specific rules and how it works, but it all stems from the passive ability of, you know, as long as Grist isn't on the battlefield, it is a 1/1 insect creature in addition to its other types. So it'll be a 1/1 insect creature in addition to being a planeswalker while it is in your command zone. So that's kind of the bird's eye view of how that works, and people seem to be a little excited to have a planeswalker as your commander. I'm not really sure there's a whole lot of support for Grist the Hungertide, though, as your commander.
I would have to agree. Like, an insect tribal deck seems like the inevitable fate for it as a commander. So it does seem to me that, like, more often we'll probably see it in the 99 taking advantage of that passive ability in kind of weird ways. Because, for example, you can reanimate this with Marin since it counts as a creature in the graveyard. Or you can tutor for it if you're looking for a creature card.
So way back when I came back to Magic, like, 7-ish years ago or so, and first saw Planeswalker cards, there weren't that many of them out there. And they were kind of this unique, mysterious thing that, like, oh, I'd see this Jace, and it felt like something very, very special. In the years since then, we've gotten so many Planeswalkers and so many versions of Planeswalkers that they've kind of lost that mystique, at least to me. This is the first Planeswalker card I've seen in a long time that feels like this weird, creepy, mythical alien thing that I don't quite know what to do with. The art is fantastic. It has a great name, and all the abilities are so specific and unique to this card. I just love everything about it, even if it isn't the strongest thing ever printed. This is probably my favorite card of the set, just as an entity unto itself. It's an absolutely creepy, delightful piece of design, and I'm probably going to build the deck just because I like the card so much and everything about it.
Yes, build more Golgari, Dana. I'm telling you, it's such a great strategy. But also, real quick, another thing to note that, like, personally, I suspect that the biggest home for this card will end up being the Sultai Sidisi, because when you mill this, it counts as a creature, so you're not giving up any creature slots in that deck, and it is a card that also helps you mill, and that is a commander who will really enjoy being able to hit that -5 ultimate ability, in case you ever get there, to make opponents lose a whole bunch of life. But Dana, I'm looking forward to see what you do with this commander as well.
I just can't wait to regenerate my Planeswalker commander with a Swarm Yard. That'll be fantastic.
Well, it only counts as long as it isn't on the battlefield.
Yeah, it won't actually do anything, but
a man can dream. A man can dream, Joey.
A man, right, exactly.
Okay, guys, so that's a whole bunch of stuff. Modern Horizons 2 is packed to the gills with a bunch of things. So what do we think? Like, is there a color that we think fared better than the others? He asks a leading question there. Is there a color that we think didn't perform a whole well? Like, what are overall our thumbs down, thumbs up, A+, F-? Like, what are the thoughts that we've got leaving the set review and carrying forward with the knowledge of all of these cards in the format now? Matt?
I mean, the set is almost certifiably just crazy good. there's something for everybody in this set. Like, if you want to play the high power decks, you can do that. If you want to play some battle cruiser, middle of the road type of decks, casual, whatever you want to do in commander, like, this set has some gems for you. It's great. It's a success. There's going to be old borders coming back again. There's old border fetch lands, which means Matt needs to take out another personal loan just to get all those old border scalding tarns. But, like, this set is a success. Like, yes, green got every other color's cool stuff, but I mean, all that aside, like, it's very, very hard to find too much fault with this.
Yeah, it's very much a throwback to Magic's history where white and red get left behind. But despite that criticism, it's just a delightful set. I love everything about it. I love the old school, like, time spiral theme where they're like, what if this instant was also a goblin and had Rampage 3? Like, this just the weird combination of things, like, let's just see what happens, is always so much fun. It's the set I'm most anticipating cracking open and playing in a long time. Commander of Legends was great. I think I like this even more. And that's saying something, because that was an absolute home run. getting this, you know, 6 months later and having me be this excited about it is also is something amazing. Someone is doing their job right there at WotC, and I love this set.
So I don't want to completely erase everything that you said, because I do agree. I am personally more excited about this set than I was for Commander Legends. Commander Legends, I'm still holding a teensy bit of a grudge about how part of the marketing for that set was powerful white cards, and then they're like, here's a Seraphic Greatsword. So, like, I still do kind of take that personally. For this set, like, I'm really digging so much of what's going on here. I do think that Red had the least noteworthy stuff to discuss, and that is a little bit sad to see. I like a lot of the steps that they took with White, but it feels to me like White took steps and Green took strides. Green is the one that just launched forward, specifically because it was doing a bunch of stuff, as you noted, that other colors can do. Green got its own Yawgmoth's Will in this set, a better version of Honor of the Pure. It got its own Urborg. It made its own Mana Dork version of Sarah Sanctum. Oh, there's Karth the Lion, a legendary creature that we didn't even actually address, which is just showing that green and black are better at planeswalkers than white is, because white still only has Jeru. Green has its own version of Empty the Warrens now, with a storm card that we didn't even discuss. And stuff that used to be mythic in green, like Lotus Cobra, is now at uncommon with Tireless Provisioner. Green is insane at this set. So even though I'm happy that white got steps, it's still being outpaced by the stuff that green is up to.
As good as they've done with white and red as well in the last couple of years, it's only so effective when green continues to take 10 steps for every one they take. That's a problem that I don't know how we address, but this is just another example of that for sure.
Yeah, we're all definitely hyped for this set for sure. But honestly, you know what? Actually, Dana, I'm thinking about it now. And really, the biggest tragedy of this is that we didn't get to hear you crooning at all with your lovely voice.
On the After Hours show.
Okay. Well, listeners, we would love to know what you think of Modern Horizons 2. Which commanders are you most excited about building? Which cards do you think will become the most popular? We would love to hear your thoughts. But for now, we are going to call this episode to a close. So, fellas, if our listeners would like to get in touch with us, where is it that they can find us all? Matt?
So you can find me on the Twitters at Mathimus55. That's MathImus55. And don't forget Wednesday evenings, twitch.tv/EDHRecCast. We are streaming. Our guests are always super, super fun. The games are also pretty great. So make sure you tune in Wednesday evenings, twitch.tv/EDHRecCast.
And Dana.
You can find me on Twitter at Dana Roach. You can hear me on my other podcast, CMDR Central. I'm writing articles once a month for EDH Rec and for Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter. And you can find the cast at EDHRecCast on Facebook and on Twitter. Plus, if you have a question, you can contact us at EDHRecCast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to the whole team at the Command Zone for handling the post-production work on the podcast. And we want to thank our sponsors, TCG Player and CardKingdom.com. You can find them using the price info links on EDHREC or by visiting CardKingdom.com/EDHREC. And that shows your support for the show. EDHREC is also always looking for new writers. So if you have an innovative idea for an article series and want to join the team, you can submit your article pitch at EDHREC.com/apply or email apply@EDHREC.com. And don't forget, you can now go to altersleeves.com/EDHRECCast and find our custom alter sleeves so you can play your decks in style while showing your support for the EDHRECCast. And you can find our Patreon exclusive alter sleeve as well. Listeners, we will be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDHREC your deck before you wreck your deck.